from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, former Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee has brought her No Excuses brand of education reform to Northern California. Rhee founded the nonprofit organization Students First last year and has based it in Sacramento. In this new role, Rhee continues to promote policies like merit pay and accountability through test scores, charter schools, and vouchers that made her a controversial figure in her old job. She'll join us for the hour next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Michelle Rhee came to national prominence as Chancellor of Washington, D.C. schools. Her brand of educational reform, which makes quality teaching the key issue of educational reform and includes emphasis on weeding out bad teachers, has kept her in the national spotlight. She made the covers of both Time and Newsweek with her positions on transforming the U.S. educational system, which also includes strong support for accountability via testing, vouchers, charter schools, and merit pay for teachers, as well as opposition to tenure and teacher unions. She was featured in the widely acclaimed film on education reform, Waiting for Superman, and in a 12-part series on the PBS NewsHour and on Oprah Winfrey. Her market-based reform advocacy has put her in direct opposition to reformers like Diane Ravitch, who recently appeared on Forum, former Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. And this past Tuesday, she appeared in Oakland at the Paramount Theater and was met by protesters. Michelle Rhee now heads up Sacramento advocacy group called Students First, which has a national reform agenda. She joins us for this morning's opening Forum Hour. And welcome, Michelle Rhee.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. And I guess a place to begin is with Students First. You're talking about actually raising $1 billion, getting a million members. What's on the platform?
So we're very excited. We started Students First a little over a year ago and had the goal, as you said, in 2011 of our first year of having recruiting a million members. We've actually exceeded that goal. We have about 1.1 million members so far. And the whole idea around Students First is to create a movement in this country of everyday citizens, whether they be teachers or parents or business owners, just concerned citizens who really do want to make sure that we are doing everything we possibly can to make America's schools the best in the world again. We focus in on three different areas in our work. The first is making sure that there is a great principal leading every school and a highly effective teacher in every classroom. The second area is around making sure that every single child, regardless of where they live, has high quality school options. And the third is around governance and fiscal accountability, making sure that there is accountability for every child and for every taxpayer dollar that's being spent. So within those three areas, you're going to see a lot of policies that we fight for, including things like high quality teacher evaluations, better laws for highly effective charter schools to be able to grow to scale, and things like pension and benefit reform.
Well, you've been a lightning rod for these kind of reforms. And as I said, former Assistant Secretary Ravitch was on with us. And a lot of the criticism that she, well, put toward you, I suppose, is one way to phrase it, had to do with the lack of concern about what is now, in fact, been corroborated as even a wider achievement gap between rich and poor. In other words, not enough emphasis on poverty and too much emphasis on teacher quality.
Well, I actually agree that poverty is a significant issue in this country that needs to be solved. What I would say is that if you look anywhere across the globe at any point in time, what has been proven over and over again is that the most effective way to combat generational poverty is through high quality education. So, you know, you can have different social programs here and there, but if you fundamentally are talking about how do you move someone out of poverty – it's going, you know, it's going to be through education. And so what we believe is that though we can't expect teachers or schools to solve all of the social ills of America, and that's just not realistic, and we've got to understand that lots of kids come to school every day with lots of significant challenges, but we also cannot abdicate our responsibility for what can actually happen within a school setting. And the research is very clear that, for example, in school, the most highly correlated factor to whether or not kids are learning or not is whether they have a highly effective teacher. So why wouldn't we as a society do everything that we possibly can to make sure that every single child is taught every single day by a highly effective teacher?
What do you say, though, to those who say that, for example, New York is ahead of Washington, D.C., where you were, in terms of poor blacks, but not with respect to the firing of teachers? You fired, I believe, about 400 teachers when you were chancellor, and there were only three fired in New York for incompetence back in 2008 to 2010.
Right. So what we would say is that if you looked over the period of time that I was in D.C. and we were there over a 3.5-year period, we made tremendous gains. And part of the reason why we did so was we put in place a lot of important reforms. Some of them were around teacher quality. But, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, how many teachers we may have let go of. But on the other side of that, on the flip side of that, the other thing that we did was we identified the most highly effective teachers in the system as well. And we, you know, we had performance pay systems in place for them. We recognized and rewarded them and valued them for the hard work that they were doing every day. We more than quadrupled the amount of money that we were spending on teacher professional development. And yes, we also identified those people who were not effective in the classroom, and we tried to either quickly develop their practice or we moved them out of the system. That's just, I think, an approach to how to deal with your workforce that any good operation or organization would have is that you have to be able to differentiate. You treat different groups of people, differently in terms of giving them the supports that they need. But you also have to understand that if someone at the end of the day is not doing the job that they're supposed to be doing for kids, then they don't have any place in the classroom.
I need to ask you, though, about 75 of those teachers who were reinstated through arbitration for insufficient explanation of why they were terminated.
Yeah, so, you know, in that case, we it was very interesting because we had a regulation on the books that said that you did not necessarily have to give tenure to every person who taught for 2 years. But in fact, if you looked at the practice of what was happening in the school district, as long as you taught for those 2 years, you were automatically granted tenure. And so we decided, you know what, we're not going to automatically grant tenure to people because we don't believe that folks should have a guarantee to a lifetime job regardless of performance simply because they've taught for 2 years. So what we did was that we put in place much more stringent mechanisms to identify those people who were not performing at the levels that we thought were adequate and appropriate, and they were not effective with kids in classrooms. And we said, for those people, you know, we're not going to grant you tenure. We're going to move you out from the system. And if you look at the regulations around what it said that teachers we needed to provide teachers to either grant them or deny them tenure, it was very clear they had to have a signature from their principal. They needed to have, you know, a certain valuation, et cetera. An explanation was not one of those things. We did things according to what our lawyers told us. And in fact, the district, I believe, is actually appealing that decision.
Talking with Michelle Rhee, who is founder and CEO of Students First, former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools, and founder of the New Teacher Project. This was done in Washington with the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which I believe is a gold standard test to a great extent. And I'm wondering what you'd say about, well, unions like the American Federation of Teachers, who say that teacher evaluation should be done largely by peers.
Well, I think that peer evaluation can absolutely be a part of the way that we are evaluating teachers. What we advocate for is to assess the quality of a teacher and the performance of a teacher based on multiple measures. So we believe that one critical measure has to be how much are the students in that classroom learning. But we also think that something that's important is observations of classroom practice. And what we did in D.C. along those lines guidelines is we actually had people observed 5 times a year. Some of those observations were done by their administrators in their building, but some of them were done by people that we called master teachers or peers who had expertise in the subject area and grade level that that teacher was teaching. We also think that there are some other measures that are very promising in terms of how to evaluate teachers, things like their contributions to the school community. Recently, a study showed that there is a very high correlation between how students rate their teachers and how effective those teachers are, you know, what parents think, et cetera. So what we believe very strongly is that you can never and you should never measure teachers on the basis of just one look at what their practice is, and that you should look through these multiple lenses.
I'd like to also hear your views on measuring student performance. Here again, test scores in California have come under serious scrutiny. There's been a lot of concern that there may be too much emphasis on test scores. In fact, that was Diane Ravitch's position. And I know that you've been looking at test scores and graduation rate. You had some certainly improvement when you were chancellor in 2007, 2009. But I believe when you look at 2009, 2011, they've gone kind of flat, haven't they?
No, actually, if you look at the NAEP assessment, which is what I think you're talking about, one of the things that we did between 2009 and 2011 in D.C. was we included more kids in taking the exam because prior to us getting there in 2007, what we saw was that the district was excluding about 13% of the population from being tested because they were special needs students or you know, had some kind of a special status. And what we did was we brought that percentage down from about 13% to between 2 and 3%. So given that we were including a lot of special needs kids, if you were actually to do an apples-to-apples comparison of the kids that we were that were being tested, and you took those special needs inclusion kids out, then our scores even through 2011 improved at a pretty rapid clip. And I think that if you ask, you know, so how much should testing play into this? How important is it? You know, California certainly has gone from first to worst. It used to have one of the best public school systems in the country, and now on a number of measures, you know, the state is really struggling. One of the reasons why we should have consistent assessments in place is so that we can understand how our kids are doing, how much are they learning. And so, you know, while testing should not certainly be the end-all, be-all of things, it is an important benchmark, an important tool that we should be utilizing. And it's just important for us to always have an assessment of, are our children learning the skills and knowledge that they are going to need to be competitive in the global marketplace?
Again, we're talking to Michelle Rhee, and she is the former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools, founder and CEO of Students First, and also founder of the New Teacher Project. Let me open the phone lines. Those of you who are listening who want to join us in conversation, who have questions or comments, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We do appreciate your contribution to the conversation. It's 866-733-6786 to join the program. Again, toll-free number available to you, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, or post questions or comments on our Facebook page. Michelle Rhee, I need to ask about this whole controversy over erasures. There's been a lot of concern about it that's been expressed, particularly by USA Today, who essentially said that you wouldn't talk to them. And let me ask you to go on record on that, if you would.
Sure. So I feel very bad that USA Today feels that way, particularly because my staff spent hours and hours and hours working with them. But, you know, the issue is that there were some questions around erasures on tests in D.C., as there are in all schools and districts across the country. And right now, the district has asked for a formal investigation from the inspector general. And I am very, very supportive of that investigation happening. You know, I think the bottom line is that we are in an unfortunate situation where sometimes a small minority of people may make the wrong decision and decide to cheat on a test. I think the important thing, though, is that I feel very, very confident that the vast majority of teachers, both in our system and across the country, would never, ever compromise their personal or professional integrity and make that decision and cheat on a test. That said, for those people who are making the wrong decision, you know, there should be very, very serious consequences for that. And so we welcome the investigation, you know, to the extent that it shows that, again, a minority of people may have been doing this, then I think the swift action should be taken around it.
I noticed that in Oakland Tuesday when you were there, there were a couple of signs that were prominent. One said D.C. has the largest white-black achievement gap, and another said charter schools leave children behind by definition. And I'm wondering if I could get you on the record on charter schools, because so much was made out of the efficacy of charter schools in the Davis Guggenheim film Waiting for Superman. And there was a Stanford study that said that charter schools outperform public schools only about 17% of the time and did worse 37% of the time.
Yeah. So I'll address both issues. First, in D.C., is there a very, very large white-black achievement gap? Absolutely. I mean, that was part of the problem that existed when I got there. And we succeeded over the course of the 3.5 years that I was there to close that gap some. But when you're starting with the largest achievement gap in the country that over decades, you know, has been developed, then, you know, that's not a problem you're going to be able to solve over a 3-year period. Did we make some progress on that? Absolutely. Did we close the gap completely? No. I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done. And as it pertains to charter schools, here's the thing. I am in favor of effective schools, whether they be traditional public schools, whether they be public charter schools, whether they be private schools. I am about kids getting a high-quality education. That's what I care about fundamentally. And charter schools are one way that that can happen. I think that, you know, if people say, well, Waiting for Superman, it made it seem like charter schools are the answer. But in fact, they said specifically in the movie that the vast majority of charter schools don't outperform traditional public schools. What I think the movie did show, though, is that there are a group of charter schools that are beating all of the odds, that are taking low-income and minority kids and doing what used to be believed was impossible. They are ensuring that they're achieving at the highest levels. So if you look at the demand that exists for those schools, it is tremendous. And it's kind of heartbreaking to see these circumstances and situations where families are desperate to get their kids in these schools because they want to escape their failing neighborhood schools and there aren't enough spaces. So I think that's part of what the movie was trying to elucidate. I think that for anyone who wants to claim that charter schools are the end-all, be-all answer, I would say that they are completely wrong. Can effective charter schools and highly effective charter schools be a huge way to help combat the problem? Absolutely. But in order for that to be the case, we actually have to hold charter schools accountable. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of charter schools out there that are not so good. And the whole idea—
Or that are very selective about who they take, I think you would concede.
Sometimes. But, you know, the problem is that the whole idea around charter schools to begin with was the idea that if they were not performing, then that they would have their charter revoked. They'd be shut down. And that you had that increased accountability in exchange for increased authority and autonomy. And right now what we have is we have the increased authority and autonomy, but we're not holding them accountable. And we're not being as aggressive as we need to be about closing down the poor performing charter schools.
The other element of Waiting for Superman, of course, that came under kind of a flailing was the role of unions. And there certainly are many who disparage unions being all about protecting teachers and keeping the seniority system in place and allowing for tenure, which means often some dead wood and all that. I'm wondering, though, what your response is to some of the counterarguments you hear. For example, the southern schools are very weak in teacher unions, or many of them have no teacher unions at all, and yet many of them, of course, have the same problems or, in some instances, are showing some successes without unions playing much of a role.
Yeah, I mean, I think in public education we have to get away from thinking that there is any one problem or any one solution to the problem, right? So for anyone who says unions are the entire problem, that's actually not correct. And furthermore, unions are just doing their job. I mean, the purpose of the teachers' union is to protect the rights and privileges and pay of their members. So how could we possibly begrudge them that? I mean, people all the time say, well, what are we going to do to try to get the unions to embrace reform? But that's not their job. The reason that they exist is not to do those things. So in my opinion, the issue is not so much the unions because they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. In my estimation of things, the problem is that we don't have an organized national interest group with the same heft as the unions that's advocating on behalf of kids so that we can have balance in the equation. The unions ought
to be able to do. Well,
presumably
we do now with Students First, though.
This is why I started in Students First. But the whole, you know, the premise that somehow unions should change, et cetera, that's not what I think we should be focused on. Let the unions do what they need to be doing so that they can fulfill their responsibilities to their members. But let's have a balance in that equation. Let's also have an organized national interest group like Students First that's advocating on behalf of children so that we don't end up with a skewed policy landscape that is favoring one side versus the other.
And again, Michelle Rhee, the former Washington, D.C. schools chancellor, is the founder and CEO of Students First. And let's go to your calls. Our first caller is joining us from Washington, D.C. Kate, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. This is Kate, and I am bi-coastal. I live literally between Washington, D.C. and Menlo Park, California, and I've been a KQED listener for many, many years. Let me just simply say this. There's an old African saying that says, beware of the naked man that offers you his shirt. I have nothing against Michelle Rhee, except that I know that the working class blacks in this town and the upper class blacks in this town rarely get together, but for the point of getting Adrian Fenty, the mayor, and Michelle Rhee out of here on a rail, they actually crossed socioeconomic lines and voted to get them out of here because the schools were being closed. Black teachers were being fired summarily. And all of this other business in terms of the smooth aspect of it and the for the children and all this business, this was about gentrification in the District of Columbia and a group of very powerful elite people coming in here and making a decision and having to have somebody get these black kids out of here into Prince George's County. Now, the rest of that stuff is downstream and interesting, but like I said, I'm an old journalist as well. And so I go literally between Northern California and Washington, D.C. So the idea of pulling the wool over anybody's eyes, the KQED listeners need to know what the real deal is and how it really went down over here as opposed to the smooth silk that they're being fed at this particular time. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Well, let's get a response from you, Michelle Rhee.
I'm not sure I heard a question in that, but if you want to look at the facts of the matter, I think one of the most important facts that you can look at is the fact that student achievement levels went up very significantly over the course of the time that we were there. I think another fact that's very important that sometimes people miss is the fact that during the course of the time that we were there, we reversed a 41-year decline in enrollment in that city. So in Washington, D.C., the schools were so dysfunctional and so low-performing that over a 40-year period, we were losing kids by the thousands. At the height of the Washington, D.C. public schools, there are 140,000 kids in the system. By the time I got there in 2007, there were less than 50,000. Every single year, that number was going down because the quality of education that we were providing with kids was so poor. I mean, literally, when I got there in 2007, of all of the eighth graders in the city schools, 8% of them were on grade level in mathematics. 8%. So you can claim all you want that I had some grand plan. That circumstance where only 8% of your kids are able to do math on grade level, that to me is the travesty in all this. What we were trying to do was reverse that trend. And we did so not only in terms of academic achievement levels, but by the last time I was there, it was the first time in four decades that we actually increased the number of kids attending the school district, which means, in my opinion, that the public was regaining faith in
doing. We're going to a break. We'll be back in a couple minutes. If you're on the line, hang on. We'll continue our conversation with Michelle Rhee. She is head of Students First. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is former Washington, D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee, who has brought her No Excuses brand of education reform to Northern California. She founded the nonprofit organization Students First last year and has based it in her new home in Sacramento. And in this new role, she continues to doggedly promote policies like merit pay and accountability through test scores that made her a controversial figure in her old job. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Soren. Good morning. You're on.
Hi, I'm a seventh grade social studies teacher at a charter school here in the Bay Area. And I guess I just wanted to thank Ms. Ree for what I see as really making the tone of the education policy debate positive. And I what I mean by that is that I feel like by really emphasizing that the quality and expertise of a teacher makes a difference in the classroom, she really honors the profession of teaching. It makes it feel like, you know, if we can get better as teachers and if we can work towards really improving things in our classrooms, then we can make a difference. And that actually means that we're in a profession that can make a difference. And I really like that. So thank you, Ms. Ree. I really like that about what you have said about teaching and education.
Thank you for the call. And we'll move on to another caller. And that's you, Gloria. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. I taught in the Redwood City School District for 34 years plus. I was a bilingual teacher. I taught the children who had no homes, who were always looking for something to eat, who didn't have very much parental support, and society didn't give their parents support. So I'd like to know, number one, because I tried to obtain this information at Students First, how long Michelle Ree taught and what grade she taught.
Sure. So I taught in Baltimore, Maryland for 3 years, and I taught second and third grade. I want to just make a comment on the prior caller and this caller together. You know, I think that the one of the things that we don't realize in society is how incredibly difficult it is to be an effective teacher in America today. I mean, if you look at teachers, particularly who are teaching in cities across this country, the challenges that they face every day, the kids who are coming in with significant, you know, obstacles and barriers to their learning. I mean, you know, people used to say to me in D.C. all the time, well, gosh, you have the hardest job in the city. And I'd always say, no, I don't. This job is a walk in the park compared to what it takes to be an effective teacher every single day. And so at the end of the day, at the bottom line, I think what we have to do is elevate the teaching profession. On the one hand, we have to understand the teachers are one of the most important strategies that we have to solve the problems that we're facing in this country. We need to understand, as Soren said, that, you know, teachers can make an absolute difference. And on the other hand, we also need to understand that teachers are going to need support, too, in order to be successful. One of the things that I was most shocked about when I was in D.C. was that we were spending about $1 billion a year on education in our city, but only about $400 million of that went into the classroom. So you had a significant amount of the money that was going to schools conceivably every day actually going to whether it's central office, bureaucracy, and, you know, these various places, instead of going into the classroom where it belonged, where it could have the most impact. And I think if you talk to teachers across the country, they would tell you that they feel that lack of support.
Keep talking about your record at D.C. as chancellor in D.C. And one of the success stories for a while that was really being put forward in terms of the media and so forth was Dunbar High School, and then that pretty much unraveled. Can you explain what happened?
Sure. We brought in an external provider, somebody who would come in and manage the school. So this was a group that had run successfully a New York City public school in New York, and they had, you know, a specific expertise in kind of the turnaround situation. We brought them into Dunbar over the course of the first year that they were there. We really did see some significant progress, both in terms of the culture that they were able to create, the expectations that they had for kids, attendance, and then student achievement levels. After I left, I think that they had some difficulties, and the decision was made, to switch the management out. I mean, I think, look, unfortunately, stuff like that is going to happen. If we had a magic solution that we could implement every single time and know it could be successful in a really troubled high school turnaround kind of situation, then I think every school district in the country would snap that up in a heartbeat. I think rather what we have to understand is that there are no silver bullet solutions. And what is unacceptable is to continue to allow our kids in our schools to fail year in and year out and not do anything different. We have to fight against the status quo. we have to be willing to try different things. Some of those things will work. Some of those things may not work. But what we can't do is allow the defenders of the status quo to maintain everything and to want to keep everything as is in place, because it's not doing a service to our children.
Again, our guest is Michelle Rhee, founder and CEO of Students First. And we'll go to another caller. And Laura, that's you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Laura Brennan, and I'm a fourth grade teacher in East Palo Alto here in the Bay Area. And my question is about merit pay. I hear that that's one of the things that Students First promotes. And I really do believe that teachers should be paid more, and it would help create a more professional environment in our profession. But I'm wondering how you think merit pay should work, Ms. Rhee, because I know that teacher collaboration is very important, and I've heard from people who work in districts with merit pay based on student performance, that it fosters more of a community of competition as opposed to collaboration. So I'd love to hear more about how you think that could work.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that we heard from our teachers in D.C. as we were putting together our performance pay plan. And so one of the things that we did was, as we were putting together the teacher evaluation and the performance pay plan, what we said was that part of what was going to factor into that system was how the school overall was doing, so that there was both a team and individual dynamic, and that there wouldn't be a dynamic where people were just looking out for themselves, but there was also an advantage to them, an upside to them, for the school overall to be doing well, so that it would foster more collaboration. And I think that those are the sorts of things that teachers and administration can come together and work through, because I think there's a lot of synergy and a lot of consensus around the fact that you don't want to hold teachers accountable just for what's going on within the school, right? Because you've got some standout teachers who might be just knocking it out of the park for their kids, even though they may be overall in a low-performing school. And you want to be able to recognize those teachers for their individual accomplishments. But you also want to have a situation where they have an incentive to want to work with their colleagues on their practice as well, and make sure you have more of a community feel. And I think that there's a way to balance those two things in a performance pay system.
And Laura, thank you for your call. Actually, here's a listener who asked another practical question of you, Michelle Rhee. It's Stephen, who says, what do parents do when it's clear that the principal is the problem? At our son's elementary school, the principals for the past 5 years have been not interested and were unable to communicate with parents, and are clearly more concerned with not making waves with the district than with doing anything meaningful for kids at the school. The teachers on the whole have been very good, some of them stellar.
Yeah. You know, I used to face that problem all the time in D.C., where I would go out and do teacher listening sessions. And I did this a couple of times a week. And my only rule at these sessions was there are no administrators allowed. I just wanted to hear from teachers. And so I'd go out in the community, either to a school or a coffee house, et cetera. And teachers would tell me these stories about their administrators who were not effective administrators. And what it was doing was it was sort of discounting or not providing legitimacy for the overall reforms that we were trying to do in terms of making it make sense for a teacher if you had an ineffective administrator.
It's also terrible
who was
for morale.
Building. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the research around teacher turnover, right, and why teachers either make the decision to stay in the profession or leave the profession, the number one factor that plays into that is the culture that's created in the school and the leadership of the principal. So my recommendation to Stephen would be to you have to make your voices heard. If you believe that what's holding your school back as an ineffective administrator, I mean, you know, you have to go to the central office, you got to go to the superintendent, you have to say, look, we do not believe that this person is effective. Here are all of the reasons why. And you have to be relentless about it. You just can't sit back. I think there are so many parents out there who are frustrated by the situations that their kids face every day in the public schools. And part of what they decide to do is, okay, well, what can I do for my own kid, right? So can I pull them out of this classroom, or can I send them into a different school or to a public school or move neighborhoods and that sort of thing? And, you know, part of what we have to do is tell parents that activism is also what can help solve the problem in the longer term. And so, you know, how do you get mobilized with other parents who I'm sure share the same concerns with you, and how can you make your voice heard?
Didn't you at one time, when there was a 12-part series based on your work profiling you on the NewsHour, ask the camera crew to follow you around because you were going to fire a principal?
I did not ask the camera crew to follow me around, no.
It's been played up in the newspapers as kind of a grandstanding on your part.
It has. That was actually not the case. But the bottom line is that I did allow a film crew to be present when I terminated a principal. Now that person's identity was protected. But what I think was an important message in that is that we were not going to allow a person to continue to lead a school when, by every single indication, whether it was visits to the school, whether it was the performance, the student achievement levels of the kids, the performance levels of what was going on there, pointed to the fact that this school was not a well-run school. We were not going to allow that person to continue on in that job. It's just not acceptable. And so if the message that people took away from that was, okay, these people are not playing anymore. You cannot be a principal in this district anymore unless you are producing results for kids, then I would say that's absolutely the message that we'd want people to take away.
Let's go to another caller. Sam, thanks for waiting. Join us with Michelle Rhee. You're on the air.
Hi. I could talk to Michelle Rhee for 2 hours myself, so it's kind of difficult to come up with a succinct question. But I wanted to say that I'm a mother, and I feel like everybody has their own personal experience with school, so I'm sure there's lots of opinions going around. I'm just finishing up the book called Class Warfare by Stephen Brill, which really helped me sort of get through some of the problems that are going on in schools. And like Michelle says, there's not one big solution for anything. But I personally grew up in Texas where they had TOS testing, which is what all of this standardized testing has been based off of. And I did not have a good experience with that. A lot of teachers were teaching for the test and seemed to be a successful school, but I felt my education was lacking. But I did want to ask Michelle if she had maybe some numbers on how many hours a good teacher has to teach and work through a week in an underserved school to be successful. I don't think it's a 40-hour week job at all if you're not in an upper-middle-class neighborhood where the parents can help with homework and everybody speaks English. I was hoping there was maybe some numbers on that.
Well, look, if you ask any highly affected teacher in a high-need situation that you're talking about, a high-poverty school, a low-performing school, they will tell you that this is way more than a 40-hour-a-week job. Great teachers, I think, are just almost essentially constantly working. They're constantly available to their kids. In some of the best schools that I've been in, the best public schools that I've been in these cities, I mean, these teachers are so committed. They come in early. They stay late. The kids are in an extended day. They're even on the weekends and in the evenings, they're planning lessons and grading papers. And I think, part of what we also have to figure out is for a lot of the schools that are most effective where the teachers are working that hard, how can we also ensure some balance for those teachers? How can we make sure that we're not burning them out so that after 3 or 4 years, they're working so hard that they don't feel like they can sustain it? And I feel that that can be done through more of the sort of a collaborative approach to say, if we're gonna work together as a fourth grade team, how can we do the planning such that we can split up some of the responsibilities and that everyone is not having to sort of recreate the wheel and plan their own individual lessons when in fact we're going to be doing very similar things. So how might we be able to do that? So I do really think that this is a problem that needs to be addressed. Is how can we create balance for those folks, because it really is. I mean, it is such a grueling and time-consuming job, and really almost, I mean, only the most committed people can be successful at it.
Michelle Rhee, I know you have to leave us. I'm grateful for the time you spent with us. And can you give out information about how people can find out more about Students First?
Absolutely. We would love people to join. We have over 160,000 members here in California and over 1 million across the country. Please go on to our website at www.studentsfirst.org. Sign up to be a member and find out more about how you can get active in your schools.
And again, many thanks for being with us on Forum.
Thank you.
We're going to continue, actually, taking your phone calls because a lot of issues have been raised. And I want to, in fact, read some of the emails here because, for example, here's an email from Ross who sort of frames, the heart of what I think is at this debate between people like Diane Ravitch and Michelle Rhee. We heard from Diane Ravitch earlier on a program a number of weeks ago, and we thought we would have Michelle Rhee on to represent really the other side, more market-based kind of incentives in education. Ross says, in your introductory comments, he's speaking to Michelle Rhee here, you said that the biggest factor in educational achievement was having a quality teacher in the classroom. I beg to differ. In fact, research shows the single biggest factor is economic status. This is borne out in a charter school my son attends in San Francisco. Those kids who come from middle and upper-class families are excelling. Those that are poor continue to lag behind. Until and unless you do more and brush off the central role of economic status in predicting educational status, you'll continue to be viewed by many as a peddler of slogans and not much more. Jen writes, the direction we're taking education is opposite what research is showing us, the importance of play, developing fine motor skills, and not cramming academics too early. The benefits of learning a second language and playing a musical instrument last throughout life, and these skills are best learned early. If a child who can and wants to read in kindergarten, great, but most kids are not developmentally ready until later. Let's not penalize them for being normal. Also, merit pay for teachers is a terrible idea. The unintended negative consequences are not difficult to predict. And as I said earlier, when you have someone like Michelle Rhee or Diane Ravitch, they're both lightning rods for all kinds of controversies vis-a-vis educational reform. And we'll continue finding out what your thoughts are through your comments. Let me go to a caller who's in Greenville, Mississippi. Kevin, join us. You're on.
Hi. Like Michelle, I was a Teach for America alumnus, but I taught in the rural Mississippi Delta region. And I think one thing that we're missing from all this conversation is I think we as a nation need to figure out how education reform looks different in urban and rural schools. Because we spend an awful lot of time talking about urban communities, but we disregard the huge number of students that are in rural communities who are being failed by the education system.
Okay, an important distinction, and I thank you for that. In fact, we just did a program recently, some of you may have heard, on differences, and they're pretty dramatic between urban and rural communities, and particularly the institutions like the schools. More of your calls. Kendall, join us. You're on.
Hi, my name's Kendall Jones, and I live in San Francisco, and I've been working with New Day for Learning and SFUSD. And I wanted to just, you know, kind of touch on the point that you had made earlier that a lot of this accountability is being put on placed on the shoulder of the teachers. And, you know, oftentimes students and families come from communities where they're facing a variety of barriers to learning. Someone had mentioned, you know, they're hungry and they can't focus if they're hungry or if they have seven cavities. So I was just wanting to point out that San Francisco has taken a new approach to including community schools. And so implementing the community school strategy specifically in the 9 schools that were found to be chronically underperforming and received the school improvement grant. And even just within their first year of implementation, have already seen not only test scores rising, but just more strategic kind of leveraging of resources from the entire community around student and family success. So just kind of wanted to bring the topic of community schools into the conversation, and people can find more information on the National Coalition of Community Schools, their website. But one kind of wanted to highlight the importance of taking not only the teachers, but the entire kind of systems theory approach to education reform.
No, I'm glad you did bring that up, Kendall, and thank you for it. A number of listeners addressing various concerns that came up in the course of our conversation with Michelle Rhee. In fact, here's a listener who says, my experience as a former student in public school is that testing too often forces teachers to follow a very rigid, boring curriculum. Testing produces lesson plans that destroys kids' natural curiosity and creativity. And of course, this argument about testing will go on and on. Is this do teachers teach to the test becomes sort of the central question, and to what extent can one rely on the validity or the strength of the test? Craig writes, what can we as concerned parents do about underperforming teachers at top-rated schools? A friend's son is failing math, and my friend had no idea because his son kept receiving hundreds on all the homework assignments. What he didn't know is that the teacher wasn't correcting the homework. When he spoke with the principal about it, he said he was not at liberty to discuss other complaints about this teacher, and his hands were tied because the teacher was tenured. Another listener writes about tenure. I think the guest may have misrepresented the effect of granting tenure. She said it guarantees lifelong employment. I believe it only grants that a firing must be done following due process. And another listener says, I'm on a local PTA board and learned that our district still has poor performance in assuring that African-American, Latino, and Native American ethnic kids graduate, get into UC schools and better universities across the nation. Let's go to another caller. We go next to, Eloisa. Good morning. You're on the air, Eloisa.
Hi. My mother had to retire early because she was putting in 50 to 55 hours of work in a week in an inner city school with bilingual students. And that was just to teach at an adequate level. And I felt that Michelle Reed really downplayed the importance of a shift in policy so that we can be putting more financial support into education. Instead, she's been focusing on good teachers and bad teachers, and she's not taking into account how many students are in a classroom and how you expect teachers to be passionate and excited about learning when they're all expected to be on the exact same page of a textbook at the exact same hour for any given grade.
All good points, and thank you for them, and we'll find out get some more reaction, in fact, to what your thoughts are about Michelle Reed. You can always go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or our Facebook page and let us know your thoughts. You're listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, so for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll take more of your calls on Michelle Reed's Penny, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I taught in the California schools locally for 20 years, and I have a lot of questions, some of which what I have to say is redundant from previous speakers. But in the same classroom, I wondered how you test certain things for performance. In the same classroom, I had recently arrived Hmong children, children from Cambodia and Vietnam. I had children from families where, from Spanish-speaking families where there was no English spoken at home, and children who came from families where the parents were illiterate. And when they started in the San Francisco schools, we had a school where there were not enough classrooms. One kindergarten class met, would you believe, in the park when the weather was good, and in the corridor in the center of the hallway. This was a kindergarten class. We had inadequate textbooks. My husband asked me why I was spending so much of our money on equipment for my classroom, and I said, because it's off my back. We didn't have enough materials. And also, my question is, what are you testing when you're testing? Any damn fool can learn scales. But what do you do to encourage Mozart?
Okay. Again, good points, and I thank you for them. That's Penny from Marinda. Let me bring Susan on from San Francisco. Susan, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for the program. What makes it acceptable for any employee in any situation to be available, as Ms. Reese said, to her students at all times, to get in early, to stay late? Do teachers have lives? Do teachers have families? This is an absurd situation. This is like going back to 19th century working conditions. And it's just, this is not a solution. What you see is even more turnover, even worse than the 30 to 50% turnover after 3 years we have now for teachers. I left the schools. My husband has left the schools. We have lives and families, and we are not prepared to work 24/7. It's absurd.
I don't know that she was advocating 24/7, and I'm sorry she can't be here to address your concerns, but I thank you for registering them, and we'll get Patrick on, who's been waiting patiently. Patrick, thank you for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, thank you. Terrific program. Thank you. Hey, one of your earlier callers noted a study connecting economic status to school success. And I think the real problem with people using studies like that generally to suggest causation is wrong when really those studies really suggest only association. And the causation often in those studies is not correlated there. So, for example, what may be there's a very strong correlation between economic status and education level, where you take a look at pre-high school, high school degree, et cetera, and go on up to graduate, you get an economic curve that is really clearly causation-oriented. So I think when you find a study that says economic status and school success, what you really may be measuring is something either education level or the high number of single mothers trying to raise kids. And it's hard enough with two parents. To do it with only one parent is terribly difficult. I bet that there's more of a causation there, but that is not studied. So you get a simple correlation between economic status, which is easy to measure, and everybody gets off on the wrong solution.
Well, again, Patrick, thank you. A lot of illuminating points from callers here, and let's get another one. Maggie, hi, you're on.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to briefly touch on what's called value-added modeling, and it's when Michelle Reed discusses attaching teacher evaluation to student test scores or merit pay, that it's related to value-added. And, you know, one of the most important pieces of research that suggests that value-added is unreliable was put out by the Economic Policy Institute, and the research was co-authored by Linda Darlingham and Diane Ravitch, among others. Linda Darlingham, and if people aren't clear, was the interim education advisor to Barack Obama before he selected Arne Duncan. But the reason I want to bring this up is because in New York State, which just recently adopted the use of value added in terms of evaluating teachers in traditional public schools. So if you are a teacher in a unionized traditional public school, you will be evaluated based on your student test scores. But if you are a teacher working in a charter school serving the same population of students, you will not.
All right. On that point, I'm afraid we're going to have to say goodbye because we have to say goodbye. I thank the caller and thank you, our listeners, coming up to the end of this hour, and appreciate your being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Ferro, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.